invite you to turn to Genesis chapter 1. While you're there, let me express my appreciation to you for your willingness to take the time to come this evening to lend your encouragement to these efforts, to show your interest in the Word of God, and to encourage not only me, but this entire congregation. Certainly good to see you. Appreciate the visitors and hope that your time will be spent in a profitable way. Our lesson this evening is God, His Word, faith in this, and faith in His creation. The word Genesis itself means origin. And we have that expressed for us in the very first verse of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Something came into being at that time that was not in being prior to that time. That's creation, and it was done by what is called divine fiat. God spoke the words, and these things came into being. Even as we prayed this evening, that God had the ability to speak the words, and these things came into being. Psalm 90, verse 2 says, "Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." God is eternal. God can do what no man or no thing can do. I remember when I was in the seventh grade, one of my teachers brought into our classroom a big record player with a 33 disc on it. That's foreign language to some people these days. But she brought that in and put the record on, and it was a recording of a man, I think it was Marshall Keeble, but I'm not certain, who was reading Genesis 1. And I was sitting there, and I confess to you, I had never read Genesis 1 in my life. I was basically an ignoramus of the Bible. I didn't know anything about it. My parents hadn't become Christians yet, nor had I. But as I heard that, two things impressed me. Number one, the incredible ability of God to do such a thing as to speak and to cause these things to come into being. And then the incredible part was that He would have anything to do with me at all would be an amazing thing. God, who is so far above all of us, the very fact that He has anything to do with us is quite remarkable when you think about it. But I could understand what was on that recording. First time I'd ever seen or heard, this time hearing, of that passage. And as a 12, 13-year-old, I could understand it. It's not a very complicated passage, but it has become so because of so many attacks that people have made against it. In the beginning, verse 1 says, "God created the heavens and the earth." That implies, it affirms, it assumes God's existence. God creates. God is referred to 35 times in Genesis 1 through chapter 2, verse 3. God is the focal point. It's telling us about what God is, what He did, and what He said. What He said is what makes these things that we see around us exist. We know that it implies God's eternity. He is before all things. The Creator has to exist before the created thing can exist. It shows us that God is omnipotent. It affirms the omnipotence of God. The omni means all, potence means power. God has all power. He creates the universe of things that we still see. It speaks of His absolute freedom. He begins a new course of action. In all of eternity, there had not been the earth. All of a sudden, He speaks it into existence. In all of eternity, there hadn't been these heavens. He speaks them into existence. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Before that was timeless eternity prior to where we are now. After us will be the endless eternity that is to follow. God made these in this interim. And then the infinite wisdom of God, the cosmos, the word cosmos itself, it refers to what is orderly. Cosmos is the opposite of chaos. God didn't create something that is out of order, that is uncontrollable, or that is just a cosmic mess. Nothing like that occurred. God created what is beautiful and good and for our benefit. And then it implies the goodness of God. There's no reason, no motive, or capacity for evil to this point anywhere in the universe. Now, notice in verse 1, it speaks of God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The word God there is a plural form. Some people say, well, this is possibly referring to the Godhead. I wouldn't deny that. It will be for certain a little later in this chapter. That will be elaborated upon in later chapters of Scripture. But plurality of persons or one Godhead, or it could refer merely to the majesty of God, as the plural sometimes does that. I don't know which is the case. It may be both. I wouldn't argue for an either or. But I do know this. Herbert Spencer, one of the main supporters of Charles Darwin, one of his earliest and most ardent supporters, outlined five ultimate ideas that encompass all that exists in this universe that God created. Five things. There's time, there's force, there's action, there's space, and there's matter. Everything we know or have any knowledge of fits into one of these categories. I find it interesting that God starts out affirming time in the beginning. We have force, God, the one who is the power behind this creation. We have action described, God created, that's a verb. We have space, God created heavens. And we have matter, God created the earth. I find it interesting that no scientist itemized a list anywhere like this until the 19th century. And here it was in Genesis 1:1, all alone. How do you account for such knowledge prior to the so-called scientific age? Well, we have a creator who knows a little bit about science, don't we? Look at what he did, after all. He's a pretty good architect and pretty good artist when you look at it as well. It says that God created. That means the universe is not eternal. There are a lot of folks who want to say that the universe always existed. But this shows that the universe is not eternal. Most atheists today are agreeing with the fact that the universe is not eternal, because all the systems would have run down by now if it were eternal. Genesis 1 affirms, before time, God began his creative work. He did it not from pre-existing materials, but he did it out of nothing. The little word for create here, the verb God, in the beginning, God created. The little word there for create refers to something that only God can do. It describes something that God did. We'll see another synonym in just a moment. But for here, note that this is a word that is very, very powerful in describing what only God himself can do. Remember that, and we'll try to come back to it in a moment. Now, in verse 2, the verse that follows 1 is simply giving us a description now of the things that are affirmed as coming into existence in verse 1. And so verse 2 says, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Now, we don't see this in most English translations, but when in verse 2 it says the earth, there's actually, in the original, a little article, a little conjunction before the earth there that is an and. And so it would read something like this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was. And some versions will have that in there, but many of them do not. That's a translator's choice, but it is in there. This shows us that what is taking place here is not looking upon verse 1 as a mere title. Remember, when Tale of Two Cities begins, it gives the title, Tale of Two Cities. And it doesn't say, Tale of Two Cities, and it was the best of times and the worst of times. That would mean the line, Tale of Two Cities, would not be a title, but the first part of the sentence. And if this started out without the and, it would know that it would be possibly a title in verse 1, if some affirm. But the fact that it starts out with an and in verse 2 shows verse 1 cannot be a title. Why is that important? Well, there are those who try to say that verse 1 is simply a title. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Then verse 2 is just merely giving another elaboration on that. And it takes out of the equation anything that God might have been capable of doing at any particular time, any particular way, and any particular series of days. It's just saying, out there somewhere in the beginning, God created, and it was this way. Now, if you notice in verse 2, the earth was without form and void. The earth that's referred to in verse 1 is being described. It was without form, means formlessness, emptiness, as in Jeremiah 4, verse 23. Jeremiah is referring to a situation in which the Babylonians come against the children of Israel. And places where there were once happy families, farms, communities, roads, houses, barns, cisterns, all kinds of things, cities, they're totally wiped away. And it uses this type of language that is used here in Genesis 1 verse 2, where it says it was without form and void. Jeremiah 4:23 says, a land reduced to the primeval chaos, according to Brown Driver Briggs. Here's what it reads. I beheld the earth, and indeed it was without form and void, and the heavens, they had no light. And so it pictures a person after the Babylonians have gotten through, and they're very destructive. And it says, these Babylonians come, and they say, after they leave, someone wanders through that area that he knows was once well inhabited by people, and he says, where are all the houses? Well, they're gone. Where are all the people? They're gone. Where are all the barns? They're gone. Where are all the animals? They're gone. What's left? Everything here has been leveled. What happened here? It's been reduced to the level it was in the creation of God. And that's his figurative way in Jeremiah of saying, here is something that is absolutely destroyed, nullified, punished to the ultimate degree. The word void that he goes on to describe refers to the emptiness. Not only are these things all destroyed, reduced to their constituent elements, but the people who once lived here are gone. There's no one to occupy these spaces. Even if a building were here, there's no one to move into it. And again, in Jeremiah 4:23, it speaks of this when he says, I beheld the earth, and it was without form and void. So this is an unfilled mass at this point in God's creation, covered by water and darkness. Now imagine if we had one person alive at this time. Where would he live? There's total darkness. There's water that covers all the things that are here. And there's no place for him to get any rest, and he wouldn't exist. Earth, immediately after creation, was unproductive and uninhabited. God is just getting started. And that's how he begins. God's making and filling take place on days 4 through 6. That will remove the emptiness. Now, in verse 2, when it speaks of the darkness was on the face of the deep. You remember what happened to the Egyptians when there were 3 days of darkness in Egypt? It shut them down. We don't function well when there's total darkness and there's no light we can turn on. There's no means of lighting some fire by which we can relieve the darkness. It shuts us down. It speaks of the darkness on the face of the deep. Waters over the earth's surface of the earth, which we'll see in verses 9 and 10, if we lived in the ocean without a boat, we'd have no means of saving ourselves, no food to eat, no light even to look for anything if it were there. The Spirit of God was hovering. That refers to the eagle's movements in Deuteronomy 32, verse 11. The eagle hovers over her young, protecting them. She hovers there. Here's the Spirit of God, thus another person of the Godhead, who is hovering over this because of the future work that is to be done. This would be the Spirit in Matthew 3:16 that lights on Jesus as a dove. Again, a hovering picture. So a craftsman many times will hover over his work. I remember a number of occasions on Saturdays I take a little bit of time to watch an artist on TV. And I would watch him start out on this canvas. And he would start in such a beautiful way. It's looking like it's going very well. Bob Ross was his name. All of a sudden, he'd toss this bunch of ink on there, paint, and mess the whole thing up. I said, look at that, he's ruined it. He'll never recover from this. 5 minutes later, he's still working on it. And then just before the show ends, it is a beautiful picture. And that's similar to the way you have it here. A craftsman hovers over his work, just like this Bob Ross hovered over his canvas. And there are parts of it that don't look good at first. But when he gets through, it is a masterpiece. That's what we have with God. The narrative then proceeds to tell us how in 6 days God organized this watery, dark chaos into a well-ordered world that we now see. So in verse 3, he starts with the light part of it. We get out of the total darkness and into the light. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. The expression, God said, occurs 10 times in Genesis 1. I think he's trying to emphasize something. When you see a word or an expression occurring that many times in a chapter, you should say, why is he saying this so many times? And it's usually for emphasis. Now, if I were to tell you, I know how the Mona Lisa was created. I know what Da Vinci did. He said, let there be a Mona Lisa, and all of a sudden it was up there on the canvas. I know how the Eiffel Tower was built. Can't remember the guy's name, but he said, let there be an Eiffel Tower. His name was Eiffel, I know. All of a sudden, there it was. Who would believe such a thing? We would count that the work, the statement of a madman or a joker. Nobody would take it seriously. We don't have that power. Only God has the ability, has the power to speak by divine fiat and say, let there be. And before he can finish his sentence, there it is. And that's what we see in this picture. Let there be light, his first creative words. He speaks his masterpiece into existence. The connection between the creation by a word and Christ the Word, who is the creator, is pretty well implied here. It will be in John 1 that we'll see Jesus, who was with this Father during this creation. Without him, not anything was created that was created, John 1, 3, who is himself, John 1, 4 and following, the light of the world. He is the one who, out of the chaos of religious error, comes and brings the proper truth that men can consider and come to him and live with him eternally. So this is light, and we're told, let there be light, the first created words that are spoken, let there be light. He sends Jesus as the light of the world. But then we're told, and there was light. Notice, it's light because of what? Did light evolve? In fact, how would light evolve? If you have a totally dark room, it's sealed off from any outside lights. No lighting on the inside. Would you say, well, let's just wait around a while and eventually this light will evolve, this darkness will evolve into light. It was totally dark and now it will evolve into light. We know that doesn't happen. But we have here where it says God spoke. It's light because he said so. It didn't evolve. And this is a temporary light before the sun, because the sun doesn't come along till day 4 in verse 14. Now in verse 4, God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. So here's the light that is called good. Good occurs 7 times in chapter 1. What God does is good. 1 John 1, 5 says God is light and there's no darkness in him at all. So it's not hard for us to understand how God could cause light to be there with or without the sun or moon or any other thing. The word good occurs those 7 times. The dividing of the light from the darkness means the alternation and the succession of one to the other. So it's dark and it's light and it's dark and it's light. And you have this usual, regular, systematic order right there in Genesis 1. Without light, there'd be no life. We couldn't have wind, the water cycle, the ocean waves would cease, and all these things would be the consequence. Weather would really be a mess. And then in verse 5, God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. So the light and the day, the light and the day, are what he emphasizes here in this first part. The light precedes the sun, 1 John 1, 5. He uses day in two senses. Here he calls the light day. That's the 12-hour part of the day. So that's how day is used in the first part of verse 5. Then he says the evening and the morning were the first day. There's a combination of both 12-hour periods, and that's the day of the 24 hours. Now, notice also that the light portion of the 24 hour period provides what has never been given up to this moment in this first day. It's the entire 24-hour period. Then the evening concludes the day, the morning concludes the night. This is going on for 6 days. And the point is the creation takes 6 days. Now, let me mention something here that gets back to what we were talking about in verse 1. Verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form. Verse 1 is not a title. Some people say, well, if it's a title in verse 1, we can make these days timeless and we can fix it so that we can believe the days are possibly billions of years. And that's the argument they proceed with there, which some that can't be. But we also see here that even those who do not believe a word of Scripture, don't believe a word of it, understand what the word day means here. They have no dog in this fight, but they understand it. For example, John Skinner of the ICC. The interpretation of Yom as eon, a favorite resource of harmonists of science and revelation, is opposed to the plain sense of the passage and has no warrant in Hebrew usage. Let's unpack that for a minute. First of all, this John Skinner was a very learned man writing for the International Critical Commentary. It's a critical set of commentaries written mostly to unbelievers. They did not believe the inspired word of God. So that's the first thing to consider. Second, not believing in the inspired word of God, this man has no dog in the fight. He doesn't care what day means as long as you get it accurately defined. He's not going to argue it has to be this or it has to be that. He knows what he believes. He doesn't care what anybody else does believe. Then the third thing about it is, he points out that this day, this word for day here, never has any warrant in Hebrew usage of long eons of time. And so he's pointing out, he's opposing those who try to say, well, we can make the Bible fit in with modern science because the day here can mean a billion years. It can be an unlimited period of time. And he's answering them, but in answering them, he states the truth in the fact. And the truth is, this word day has absolutely no usage for this great period of time that someone would make it. It's used in Genesis 1 of 24-hour period. Of a regular day and night, the day and night, the day and night. Now, we'll go back to that more a little later, the Lord willing. But in verses 6 and 7, God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, let it divide the waters from the waters. Thus God made the firmament, divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. So the evening and the morning were the second day. We call this firmament an expanse. The Septuagint had called it something that meant a firm, solid structure. So what they looked up and saw, they thought was a sort of like a bowl turned upside down, and it was firm, and it was solid. So the King James took the word firmament from the Vulgate firmamentum, and they made it into something that was more or less solid in the way it was viewed. At least that's how people took it. Genesis 1 uses it interchangeably of the open expanse of the heavens where the birds fly, verses 6 and 7 and 20. It's that open expanse. It's a place between the waters and the outer space. And it's also used of the place where God put the lights of heaven. So it's used in the second sense of the place above our atmosphere where the stars are. So it can be used in these two ways. Verse 6, he would divide the waters from the waters. There would be a vertical separation of this water that is down here from this soupy stuff that is on top of it, this atmospheric water, and it would bring it up and give the firmament the space in between its ability with atmospheric pressure, we call it today. The clouds and things up here full of many, many billions of gallons so that they would be separated. The fact is there are 37.5 million billion gallons of water in the atmosphere. That's quite a lot of water. If that all falls on one place at once, it's gone. It's history. Now, it says these things were made. A different verb from verse 1, but not very different from creating. We talk about a craftsman, if he could speak something into existence, which he can't. And then if he continues to work on it and to polish it and to do what Bob Ross and others did with paintings, that'd be a pretty good picture of what he's saying here. Only with God, it's much more complicated. He says, and it was so. He didn't say it was good. The third day will finish the good part of this, and it will be a good after every other of the days. The third day will finish day two, in verse 10. Heaven is from the word that means to heave, the idea of heaving something up. So this expanse with its atmospheric pressure pushes up what we see in that thing called the heaven. And then verse 9 tells us that the Lord, that God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. The waters under the heavens are gathered. There's a horizontal separation there, as we saw. The dry ground on the earth, we don't live on a planet covered by water. So you have the vertical separation, the expanse there. Now you have a horizontal separation where the land is uncovered and the water goes to its depository, and the land is now sticking out from the water. There's now something for things to place their feet on, though there are no things yet to do that. The dry ground he calls the earth. He talks about the earth and the grass and the things that he brings forth from this in verses 11 to 13. God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the third day. Now on this third day, the earth and the grass, according to this kind, that expression occurs 9 times in Genesis 1. According to its kind. Ancient people worshipped a fertility god. Genesis 1 shows that this is part of God's handiwork. And then you notice also, and he says, and it was so. And it was so occurs 6 times in Genesis 1 with great regularity. So some plants and trees need insects to pollinate, and if they don't come into existence till the 6th day, and verse 1 is just a title, and verse 2 just goes on saying that everything is timeless, you'd have things in need of pollination billions and billions of years before those insects come and are able to do that. So that's another argument against the long time periods people try to crowd into this passage. The lights, verses 14 and 19. God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons, and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. Then God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth and to rule over the day and over the night, to divide the light from the darkness, and God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the fourth day. Now this greater light to rule the day, we typically call the sun. One typical flare on this sun is equal to several million 100 megaton hydrogen bombs. This is a powerful thing. This is no small firecracker God put into the sky. And he got it up there by saying, let there be. So it's not merely let it appear, as in the dry land appeared. The dry land was there, but it had to appear when the water walked away from it. But this is let there be. Let there be lights in the firmament, that is in the expanse, this upper expanse. The earth existed before the sun and the moon and the stars, since they were created on the fourth day. The sun radiates the light. The moon reflects the light. The average distance between galaxies is about 20 million trillion miles. And you know, if we could look up in the sky on any given night and pick out a circle the size that the moon is when it's full, if we could look to the side of that moon, here's the moon, here's that same size beside that moon in that little circle, and look up all the way into the every area of the sky, it would have a million galaxies in that little circle. Then here's the moon, here's this little circle, look at that circle beside it, another million galaxies. And thus all over the sky, every place where you could place the size of a moon, if you could see far enough, you would see a million galaxies. to think about the size of this is absolutely beyond our ability to comprehend. But that's what God has done. That's what you expect from someone who is perfect and who is all-powerful. He says he would divide the day from the night, the day and the night, the signs and the seasons, the days and the years. And the expression here is the signs. They would be for signs and for seasons. We have the word meaning a banner or a wonder or a mighty act of God is in Exodus 4 when Moses has the signs to prove to the children of Israel that he came from God. Jesus talked about it from the standpoint in Matthew 16:3 of predicting the weather. You look out, the sky's red and lowering, you know you're in trouble. Well, these are signs in one way, by their very existence, very similar to those of Moses. This is the miracle of God that he made to be a constant daily sign to us. In 1969, when Gene Cernan lifted off into outer space, he wrote the book called Last Man on the Moon. He said in less than 15 minutes, he was 116 miles high, circling the globe, accelerating to 24,300 miles per hour. That's very slow, by the way. 24,300 miles per hour. And he made this comment. He said, looking back at Earth, I saw only a distant blue and white star. Out where I was dashing, stars in eternal distant blackness were everywhere. No one in his right mind can see such a sight and deny the existence of a supreme being. Some power placed our little world, our sun, and our moon where they are in the dark void. It is just too perfect and beautiful to have happened by accident. It's as though a person were stranded on an island. He starts to look at the island to see what all is there, and he comes across this beautiful village. Does he say, oh, there must have been a volcano eruption? Is that what would have caused that? Oh, there must have been a strong wind. Would that have caused that? No, there's the cause and effect relationship. The cause has to be great enough for us to believe it's given us this result. When we look at all this that is here, the beauty of it, the way it is there, the way it's consistent every way, we have to say, along with Gene Cernan, it's just too perfect and beautiful to have happened by accident. As for days and for years, we still use it in that way. And I think about the movement of the heavenly bodies, the longest measures of time fixed by God's decree. And I think about the occasion when Napoleon and his men were on a ship. And his men, atheists, were arguing that there is no God with some of those who actually believe there may be a God. And they said, let's go ask Napoleon. And they went and they said, Napoleon, is there a God or is there not? And he looked up to the heavens and he saw the stars and he said, gentlemen, who made all this? And that answered the question. That was how simple it is. And that's what Genesis 1 is meant to do for you and me. People think they're lucky stars. They think of good fortune. They think of their fortune-telling ability, the horoscope and various things. Don't go out of the house if something like this happens, if the stars are not in their proper place. God is the one who put those there. They're not scientific gobbledygooks. They're not things that men can make up and replace what God has done. They're things that God made to prove his existence, his power, his wisdom, and to cause us to be in awe by the things he made and let us know he's there. Romans 1, Psalm 8, and various other passages argue in that very manner. Psalm 19 as well. Ellen Boyd was asked once, is there a scale model of the universe? And his response was, it can't be built. He said, if the earth were a one-inch ball, make the earth a one-inch ball in that scale model, the nearest fixed star would be 40,000 miles away. That'd be a little hard to make, wouldn't it? Well, he says if you make a smaller model, make a 1/4 inch from the earth to the sun, which is actually 93 million miles. So make it 1/4 inch from the earth to the sun. Cover it with a dime. And Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars would fit on the coin. The orbit of Mars would be the circumference. Neptune would be 14 inches away. The nearest star would be 1 mile away. And if you wanted to depict the center of the universe on this scale model, it would be 6,000 miles long. It's the distance from Los Angeles to London. Obviously, no one has ever made a scale model of the universe. But if you were to see a miniature, not by scale, model of the universe, would you look at it and say, oh, look what happened as a result of an explosion? You wouldn't, would you? But what is even more complex and even more infinite, people try to say that very thing. Now, the lights in these passages, verses 14 to 19, this word for signs is helping us to understand that God is the one behind these things. As Jesus pointed out in Matthew 16:3, the seasons, the appointed time that God has made for us, the days and the years, the lights in the firmament, and the greater and the lesser light. And he says, and it was so. It's not that it started to become so, but it was so. Some claim long periods for starlight to show, for it to reach the earth. Well, Genesis 1 deals with the miraculous. And there could be no star there at all had it not been for God saying, let there be. And that takes care of the fact that God is dealing with the miraculous. He spoke the universe into existence. He gave us a grown man and woman. He didn't start with babies. What would a baby do to feed itself if it had no mom and dad? There would be an infinite regress to keep going and say, well, this baby has to have a parent. Well, that parent would have to have somebody too. And so he started with a grown man and woman who had the ability to feed themselves. What would Adam and Eve eat if God waited for them to learn the natural law? The trees were bearing fruit. What would Adam and Eve eat if God had made trees already bearing fruit? If they waited for a few years for the trees to bear fruit, they wouldn't have food and they would starve to death. These are the things that God made in maturity appearance, even though they're a day old. You look at Adam, what could he look like? 25 years old? When he's one day old. He already has the cognitive skills of a grown man, though he's a day old. He's able to name creatures, though he's not even a day old yet. He's only his first day of life. That's the way God made it. So you're dealing with the miraculous here. People tend to forget that. The evening and the morning were the fourth day. That's the days of 1 through 3. And then in verse 20, then God said, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created great sea creatures, every living thing that moves, with which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. So the evening and the morning were the fifth day. Now, as you look at the living creatures, the earth brought forth plants. The living creatures populate the waters. Let the waters swarm with swarms, quite literally. The winged creatures populate the expanse. So the earth has the plants. The living creatures populate the waters. The winged creatures populate the expanse. This cancels the void of verse 2. It's no longer void. It's occupied. Grown birds are flying. They have the ability to fly. They don't have to be pushed out of the nest by a mother. They had no mother, the ones that started originally. And then in verse 21, the great sea creatures, the sea monsters. Every living thing that moves, and this enabled people to fish and to live according to the sea. It was done according to its kind. 9 times in this chapter of Genesis 1. This is reproduction, not change into other kinds. And then he says it was something that is good. It was done instantaneously, not through eons of time. And he told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and multiply on the earth. Then in verse 24, God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind. Cattle according to its kind. Cattle, creeping thing, and beast. And he says, and it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. In verse 24, the cattle, the livestock, the domestic animals. That's where they come into play here in this fifth day. The creeping things that move about lightly or glide about. That's what the word actually means. The beast, the wild animals, the game. And the sixth day is the most important of all because there comes man. God said, let the earth bring forth all these other things, but he didn't say that about man. He said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Here again, let us, plural, make man in our image, again, plural, after our likeness, plural. Here, obviously, is the Godhead. And you notice he says, let us make man. Let us make man in our image. Now, he will say further in chapter 5, verse 2, he created them male and female and blessed them and called them man. The New King James says mankind. But it's a typical word for man. No problem with mankind, however. In the day they were created. And also notice, he says we're to make man in our image. As in James 3, verse 9. We're made in the image of God. How can you curse someone who's made in the image of God, James asks. God established this unique fellowship with man. No animal can evolve into this thing that God made in its own special way. These were made in a very special way. They weren't even made like the other creatures that God made was made. As Adam was made in his image, the incarnated Son became the image of Adam later. Now, they were there to have dominion over the others. And Psalm 8 speaks of this. And ironically, man uses his dominion to deny the existence of his maker. But verse 27 points out that God created male and female. Notice there are no other options. There's no half man here. There's no man-woman or woman-man or one who doesn't know what he is. There's no man and man. There's no woman and woman. There's a man and there's a woman. How simple. A lot of Americans need to read this passage. And you notice also, he blessed them, not only with gifts, but with purpose. He will point out to them the deeds they need to do, the work they're going to be given. He tells them to be fruitful. The powers of reproduction are theirs. And this would be through the marriage arrangement. And that stands as the pattern that Jesus uses in Mark 10 and Matthew 19. They're to subdue, that is, have dominion over the animals. This is not politically correct, but it's still biblically actually true. Then in 29, and God said, see, I've given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth. And every tree whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life. I've given every green herb for food, and it was so. Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. The sixth day being the most important. God said, and it was so. Each occurs six times in Genesis 1. You'll notice the expression for the food. He will add meat in chapter 9, verse 3, but not until then. All creatures depend on the plants. He says that what he did was very good. It took man to bring bad into the world. But all that God brought into the world was good. And then he tells us in chapter 2, verse 1, thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. Now, the host, there are hosts of angels. We talk about the host, the heavenly host that sang the praise of God. Those are angels. The stars, probably the stars are more in line with what he's talking about here. And they just were finished. That means to come to an end, to put a stop to. The act of creation stopped with this period. And we're told in verse 2, on the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. So verse 1 will talk about all these were finished. Verse 2 will talk about his work being ended and about him resting, not because he's tired, but because the act of creation is finished. He ended his work. Here's the ending of the creation process. Hebrews 1:3, he still upholds all things. God still works, but he's not still creating as we see in this chapter. It says that God rested. It doesn't mean he's tired or he's retired, but his task is completed. He ceased from his work, Hebrews 4, verse 10. He who has entered his rest himself also ceased from his works as God did from his. The word ceased there is a very fascinating word. There are many times when I will think I'm through with a project. I get back and I look at it and I say, well, I'm not through yet. I've got some corrections to do. I've got some more work to do. God looked at his and said, it's all perfect. Of course it would be, because he's God. He had no revisions necessary. And so we see a threefold emphasis. They were finished, they were ended, and he rested. Now, in verse 3, then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which he had created and made. Well, he blessed what he did, but he did not command people to observe the Sabbath until Exodus around chapter 20. Israel was basing the pattern of keeping the Sabbath after the pattern of God's creation. He worked for 6 days, he rested the seventh. And so that's what we see that God commanded his people of Israel to do. The word created and the word made, again, we saw these earlier, they are synonyms. They're not simple organisms that are progressing through natural processes into more complex species. Now, that's the introduction. Don't panic, we're about through it. But that's the introduction. But look at the couple of applications here. Genesis 1 contradicts errors. Polytheism, and I'm turning to Acts 17 to illustrate this, and it'll be quick. But he tells us, verse 23, therefore the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you. The one who's the unknown God. There is one God. You've got all these gods around here in Athens, but you don't know the one true God. You've got all these false gods and don't know the one true God. And that's what Paul is arguing. He contradicts the eternity of matter. In chapter 17, verse 24, God who made the world. There was a time when the world didn't exist. Matter is not eternal. God is eternal. And he made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Furthermore, it refutes Gnosticism, the evil of matter. Matter is evil. No, these are things God made, and thus they are good. And you see that very clearly in verses 24 and 25. He's not worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, though he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And it's arguing against theistic evolution, because dirt and rocks were created. He says in verse 26, he's made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, so they should seek the Lord in the hope they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. And then the second thing we see here, George Wald, the Harvard neurobiologist, acknowledged the absurdity that chance created the universe. Couldn't happen. He said, one has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to conceive that the spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. That's a Harvard professor who nailed it. But that's a very serious consequence for a person who believes in evolution. So he had to add this. Yet here we are, as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation. Now wait a minute, you have to be pretty smart to contradict yourself in this close of a juncture. One has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to conceive that the spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Yet, I believe that's how we got here. It's impossible, but I believe that's how we got here. Who is it who's gullible? Who is it who's believing in fairy tales? Now, how does he justify this? Time is, in fact, the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible. Time itself performs the miracles. So that means Jeremy brings a rock up here and he puts it down right there. Time goes by and he says, eventually, that rock is going to turn into a baby. Just give it time. You say, Jeremiah, that's impossible. That's impossible. Oh, but given enough time, anything can happen. How long would Jeremiah stay here? How long would you have any confidence in him at all? Oh, but he says, I went to Harvard. I studied under George Wald. Oh, okay, I guess you have a point. That's how the academic community views what we just saw. We think this is the funny papers. They say, no, this is serious stuff. The accounts of the origin of life and other religions are trivial and silly. In fact, they're pretty silly when you look at the so-called first causes of some modern scientists. Richard Dawkins, in the movie Expelled, many years ago, 10 years ago, 11, 12, when Ben Stein was interviewing him, how can you believe that life just spontaneously generated? And he said, well, it may not have, but he said, there's another possibility. It may be that aliens from other planets came down and they seeded the earth. Oh, I wonder where they came from. Who seeded them? And you get into, again, an infant regress. Somebody had to start this at some point because they admit matter is not eternal. So here's one of the most erudite professors, who's rather self-contradictory much of the time. But he says, I think it could have happened in this silly way of aliens coming down and starting all this. Well, where are these aliens? Why don't they come see us sometime? Don't they like their offspring? Mom and Dad, come see us. It's all so foolish. There is nothing childish or silly in the biblical account. Arthur Thompson, on the Outline of Science, says, if we say, as was said long ago, in the beginning was mind, we may be expressing or trying to express a great truth, but we've gone behind science in the two words. In other words, there are certain things science cannot determine. Science just cannot determine certain things. Professor Dampier Wetman, who died in 1952, compiled a book called The Cambridge Readings in the Literature of Science. He's a great British author. It includes extracts from the most influential works of science from the days of the Greeks, pages from Aristotle, Galen, Copernicus, Galileo, Newton, Kepler, Herschel, Laplace, Pasteur, Faraday, Lord Kelvin, and so on. But on the first page of this book, listing the ideas of all these scientists, he listed, without comment, the entire first chapter of Genesis. He says, if you want to know how we got here, here's the first scientific textbook we need to see. And I would commend that to you, because while we've seen just a smattering of this evening, we haven't covered anything in detail in chapter 2. But it shows us, we have a God who is all-powerful. If that's the case, it answers every question someone may have. We don't know everything. We have a God who does. And we're grateful that that is the case. It could be that someone in this audience this evening, on considering these matters, who has never become a Christian, knows he needs to do so. We will stand for your convenience. We will sing for your encouragement. Invite you to come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, repenting of your sins and being baptized by his authority, that your sins may be washed away by his blood. If that appeals to you, come all together, we stand and sing.